this is the latest episode of the VFX Existential Crisis podcast. I am Chris. This is Graham. And we wanted to do a follow-up on our last one where we got a little bit personal about job instability. We had some questions about, you know, well, what do you do, Chris? Like, what have you done? And, you know, good and bad. Maybe there's things we can both share that we've done that have helped us out or not helped us out on sort of getting your finances in order. I think it's super important once you realize that the bottom could come out at any moment, that you take your own money the most seriously. Not everybody wants to do that, but you kind of have to if you want to be successful. That's why I wore my Wu-Tang shirt. Cash rules everything around me. because Wu-Tang, Disney, and Las Vegas are pretty amazing at getting your money. Like at the Wu-Tang show, there's like commercials for every Wu-Tang person and whatever side project they're doing. They take their own money seriously, and I think that's words to live by. The other thing I realized as I was thinking about this podcast, which, and sorry, my green microphone is going to be cutting out, but didn't think about that when I bought the windsock. But as I was sort of writing this stuff out and trying to get it ready for this podcast, I realized that it's kind of the same approach that I take when analyzing a new project, whether it's my own project or a project in distress or a project that's not in distress, but maybe is looking for feedback because as you may know, I've been a producer and a VFX supervisor, but I'm also in a position often where I'm overseeing multiple producers or projects, and all of them have a kind of different flavor to them. And particularly the ones that are in distress. Now, hopefully your finances are not in distress. but I may take on a slightly judgy viewpoint in part because I'll be putting on my producer switch, which is can be a touch ruthless at times. And I think, you know, if particularly when you have a project in distress, there's a whole bunch of people that are clearly trying to make something useful and good who have lost their mind in some way and can't see the obvious things. This is the common theme. Everyone's too in the weeds. They can't see the forest for the trees, whatever, you know, metaphor you want to use, but they often there's obvious things right in front of them and they just can't do them because they're hard or everyone's panicking. I'm sure you've seen that.
Oh yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. The panic. So often what I do in those situations, I come in and I go through a process, which is also kind of useful for your financial, personal financial setup. And, you know, start with, it's not that hard. Like fixing a project isn't that hard either, actually. Producing a project isn't that hard, really. It's not easy, but it's not, the ideas are simple. It's not necessarily easy to do. But so reminding yourself of the simplicity of some of these things and not overthinking them is kind of the key thing here. So there we go. That's what, so I'm going to be doing a lot of the talking, and Graham, you know,
I'm going to represent the educated or the becoming educated, because Chris is way better at this than I am. So I may be the...
I'll be the one judging you.
You're judging. Yeah, I'll be the judge. So this is good. We got it all covered.
Okay. All right. So we've got our good cop, bad cop set up. Okay. So first thing you do, no matter what situation, obviously, the first thing I should say is you're listening to financial advice from dudes on the internet. Immediately, that's something you should be like, hey, wait a second. And whatever advice you're listening to, you know, we're not financial advisors, so you should take this with a grain of salt. Do your own research, hire the right people, do whatever you need to do. There's the disclaimer. Don't sue us if you lose your money. That's your problem. But you should also realize that everyone who's giving you advice usually has some kind of agenda. In general, with most problems in production as well, if you follow the money, you'll find the problem, right? So if a bank is telling you, hey, why don't you buy this easy system? They're making money off you. If, you know, Wealthsimple or, you know, RoboAdvisor or any financial advisor. So one of the first things you want to get used to is challenging, right? Like, I don't have a problem with this, as most people who work with me know. But like, how are you making your money? That's an uncomfortable question that I think particularly Canadians, you know, who are a little bit more polite sometimes may not want to ask, but it's the question you should definitely ask. And I have been burned by not asking that question enough. So anyways, so that's something you should just know right off the top. You should question everything a little bit and do your own research. Cause that's, you know, we were talking about, you know, hey, do something when your job instability, one of the best things you do is learn about money. You know, they want it. The whole industry wants to make it so confusing. And in the end, it's pretty simple stuff. We could boil it down to save more money, like save more money than you make and invest it wisely. That's really it. You can tune out now if you want.
Yeah, arguably, the more complex it is, the more likely they're scamming you in some format. I mean, 100%. You see this with video games and things where you don't buy things for a dollar, you buy it for a token, but the tokens cost $3. And, you know, they make it abstract, so they don't realize you're spending money, and suddenly you are, you know.
For sure.
And, you know, your question about how are you making money, it's a great question if you're in any kind of business and you're trying to figure out what the vendor who's selling you something is doing. Are they getting a license fee? Is it a percentage? Like, understanding what the needs and wants are of your potential co-partner are valuable.
No one cares about your money more than you, right?
But if you don't care about it, you're in trouble.
You're in trouble, or you're living large, or you have. And even if you have a partner or who is great at money, that's not good enough. This is something my mother taught me. It's like, you need to know, what if that person goes away, dies, leaves you, whatever, it can happen.
Yep.
And particularly, traditionally, women were not necessarily up on finance and stuff. My mother is a freaking wizard at it, and this is why I'm good at it as well. And that was because that was her way of, like, independence, make sure she's independent. She came from a poor family, there's that as well, but so it's important. Like, my wife's not super interested in it, but I make her endure my yearly report, so she knows what it is. And I'm making my children do it as well. So that even if they're not as interested in it as me, they at least have a recollection or some kind of familiarity with what's going on. And in the house, I'm pretty open about where we're at financially. So there's a trend lately too, where younger people are much more open to sharing information, which I'm not a huge fan of still, because I think it's sort of a private thing, but I'm going to do my best to give some generic advice with that in mind. So you've got a situation. It's your own situation. I have notes, so I'm going to just go refer to my notes, which I wrote in a kid's soccer practice at night. So it's hard to read, but so basically the first thing you want to do is assess your situation. Forget about details, forget about all the stuff, macro first. Paint the big picture, give yourself the box to work within. So are you spending more money than you're making? That's a simple thing. You can go through, a lot of banks now will tell you, you're spending this, you're bringing in this much. Dead giveaways for that are you carrying credit card debt? Are you paying your credit cards every month, or are you carrying them a month to the next month? If you're carrying them, you're spending too much money. 1,000%, you're spending too much money. If you have a line of credit, you're spending too much money. Now, people in desperate situations where they're like, they've lost their job and this is a thing, that might be a different story, but it's still the same thing. Your first thing you want to do is you need to get money. The second thing you want to do is get to a level playing field, and getting to a level playing field or ahead is not spending more money than you have, right? So you have to take care of those things before you can start thinking about investing and all that kind of stuff. And so that's like the number one thing that I always ask when people ask me, I'm like, well, what do you carry a credit card debt? Because those are really bad habits that you're paying massive interests. And, you know, if it was a project, it would be low hanging fruit. Like, well, which department is struggling? Which department is doing well? You know, it's not always negative. It's like, which things are working for you? Which things are not? So, well, I'm saving money. I'm saving $100 a week into this account, but I'm paying my credit card interest. Well, then that's bizarre. So you need to get your bad debts to zero. So then you can move forward. Does that make sense?
And it goes back to your initial point about people taking advantage of you. Like, easy credit is such a trap. Like, I remember when I was at university, mm-hmm. It was the first time out of house, I got my OSAP, and then they're handing out MasterCards to the students, almost with like, you fill out a form and you get a card, and they hook you early. So you get addicted to that easy credit for sure.
Yeah. A credit card should be for cash flow only. And if you think about it from a business perspective, it's like, if you're essentially taking a loan, if you don't have the money right then, but you know you're going to get it, you know, soon, and you can, you know, net out to zero in whatever, you know, small cycle, then it's fine. But if you are constantly building up debt, credit cards are charging like 18 to 20% interest. That's like insane rates. So before anything, just stop this video right here and go and make sure you take care, stop and cut up those credit cards, because that is the worst thing ever. There's some judginess for you. Stop it right now. You're definitely spending too much money. If you're the line of credit is probably, this is the thing too, is like, if you're really in bad debt, then you maybe need to start to see like a debt consolidation expert, because that's not my expertise. I can't physically let myself be in that position. It would drive me insane. I do not like being in debt to anyone or anything. And maybe some would argue it's like, I'm maybe too focused on debt when looking at investments and stuff like that. Like, you can take on good debt. Like, a lot of businesses, there's a logic of like, well, it's better to use someone else's money than your own money to a business. But if you take that too far, you end up like, you know, how many VFX companies have, like, they go under like that all of a sudden, and everyone's like, whoa, that happened. You know, it wasn't. It was a slow build. They built up more and more debt. And then someone said, I'd like it back, please. And then they're like, oh, I can't pay. Then they have to go bankrupt, and it's a fire sale. So you don't.
Yeah, there's also the case of, yeah, like the sort of studio case too, where like you're it's kind of the credit card analogy. You're borrowing money from the next show to cover the losses on the current show, and it becomes a bit of a cycle. And then you really become reliant on that next gig coming in to keep the wheel turning. And when the wheel stops, if that next gig doesn't come as you had planned, then boom, it's a jam. So we saw a lot of companies go bankrupt over the strikes and the subsequent fallout. And it's really because the cash flow just kind of seized on them.
If you can justify, like, there's a caveat here. If you can justify, like, okay, I'm going to buy this microphone because it enables me to get this next job and then pay for it in the next job. Okay, but that's more an investment. But if you're, like, going out for dinner and putting on your credit card and then letting it lapse and paying 20% on that, lost the plot. So people may not want to hear that, but it's true. So you need to figure that out, like, right now. Line of credit is one step better, but it's still the same idea. Like, I'm borrowing money to pay for something. So you're paying for a renovation. Okay. Do you have a concrete plan to pay that back in a certain amount of time? Then maybe it's reasonable. But if you don't have that plan, then it's just freewheeling. And eventually that's going to catch up to you. Plus, it's a horrible way to live, I think, to be in debt and desperate, because it creates desperation. It creates pressure. If, you know, if I don't have any debt and I don't have any money, then I just don't buy stuff. If I have debt and don't have any money, there's someone chasing me for money. And, you know, like collectors start coming and it's just like, Jesus, that's like,
it's terrible. Empowering to have a windfall.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, you know, you're underwater. You need to get above water. Now, there are some better debts. Like I would say, you know, a mortgage potentially is a better debt. Student loan is a better debt. Some people might be listening that have student loans where there is some kind of, it's usually lower interest rates, hopefully. And it's longer term, and you can't get a mortgage without them making a plan for you to pay it back. So unless you've bought like a $2 billion house when you shouldn't have, which is possible, especially in Toronto, that debt is at least something a bit more manageable. Car loans are like in one of those things where it's on the edge. You know, I've never had a car loan. I've been lucky enough. I just buy crappy cars but that's something, particularly if you're commuting to work and you're depending on where you're living, it's a fact of life and cars are really expensive now. So that's something you may have to deal with. But again, you have to look at that in your overall picture and say, okay, well, that's a drain on my potential investment or potential windfalls down the road. So how am I going to deal with that in the short term? So,
and notoriously a bad investment too. Like you drive the car off the lot and it's like got half the value you paid for it instantaneously, yeah. Basically.
Yeah. So, but at least, you know, so if you start to think like that and you're really critical about those kind of things, maybe you get a cheaper car or you at least build a plan to pay it back, and make sure you're sort of okay with financing. But the more debt you take on, the more you're exposed to volatility. And that's, I think, a big one. So anyways, so figuring out your kind of like your situation is the first thing. All right. And then like, I would say if you're thinking about it from a project perspective, it's like, is this project doing okay? Is it doing well? Are they killing it? You know, it's kind of like that. Or is this a disaster? You know? So sometimes when a project's doing okay, there are signs where it could tip one way or the other. And so like, that's like, if you have some money, but you have some credit card debt and you can't pay it off, maybe that's in that zone. And then if you're like, you've got a car loan and a mortgage and a line of credit and whatever, that's kind of like in the disaster zone. And then maybe you're better off. You don't have those things and you have money and you're kind of flush. Good for you. That's the best place to be. Or maybe you're starting to think, well, you know, job stability. Okay. We're kind of in that okay zone a little bit again. So, but anyways, having a general picture and a feeling of like a data driven feeling of where you're at, I think is important because it sort of, changes your initial tone, right? Like if you're in a disaster, you need to act fast and do obvious thing, big things quickly. If you're flush, then you can maybe be a little bit more specific and maybe wait a little longer to look at the trends and see what your things are doing. But if, you know, if you're underwater, and then the other thing you want to also figure out is, okay, what's your horizon? So same with the project. This one's a disaster and it's due in 8 weeks. Well, clearly we're going to take rapid big action quickly, right? It's a disaster, but we have a year to figure it out. Okay, well, we want to take big actions, but maybe we don't want to like panic, right? You don't want to panic as well. So from a financial perspective, it's like, okay, well, you know, how old are you? You know, so we're kind of like in the 10 to 15 year retirement zone. which is not long. That's theoretically like short, medium term. One piece of advice I got from my financial investors, maybe one of two things that I'll talk about that are of any use before I fired them, was when we had our firstborn, it was like, that's your priority. Because it's like, oh, it's only 18 years away. And I was like, what? And because I was like all focused on retirement and getting that up because, you know, we don't have pensions in VFX and animation, all that kind of stuff. So it kind of woke me up. I was like, oh, actually, that is, and having lived it, and my daughter's just about to go to university, it's like, oh, yeah, it happened fast.
Yeah, it's the best thing we ever did. We did RASPs out for both of our kids, and basically the school was covered. So even though they went to, I don't know, 3-year programs each, it's not a financial burden. My daughter's in college now, and if we hadn't planned, I'd be sweating buckets for sure.
Yeah. So that's like, so you got to look at your horizon and your time frame. And if you have more, like if you're 20 and you've got, or you're say 30 and you have 35 years before you're 65, then you have a longer window and you can do more things and you have the power of time to help you compound interest and things like that, assuming you're not underwater with your debt and stuff like that. So the horizon's important. Then you need to figure out, okay, what's your deal? What's your, and so like when I'm on a project, the first I watch a little bit and I go, okay, that person's an optimist. That person's a pessimist. That person's like completely lost their mind. They can't, they're so in the weeds, they can't think anymore. This person's often in disaster projects, there's people that are like, not participating as fully because they either can't handle it or they're not being listened to. And then there's people that are over participating. So like, are you panicky about money? Are you like anxious about money? Does it stress you out? You know, how much time do you really, are you really going to spend, or do you want to spend on it? Like a lot of people talk a big game about, oh, I'm going to do stocks and blah, blah, blah. I realized pretty quickly, it's like, I want to do this. I want to think about it, but I don't want to actually do a lot. So my approach has been, it's called the couch potato approach, because I realize, oh, that's probably good for me. Like I'm going to look at it seriously once a year and I'll look at it occasionally, but I don't really, I'm not day trading or anything like that because I have no interest in that. And so you got to be real with yourself. So this is a time to take a step back and like really get real. You know, it's good to have someone else kind of like, you know, yeah, go in the mirror, slap your own face and like start again. Because I think a lot of people, when you talk to them about money, they're like, oh, well, but, and it's the exact same kind of pathology and psychology you see in panicky projects where it's like, yeah, but I don't know. And there's all this like hyperventilating. It's like, okay, relax, just wait, take a deep breath. What's the problem you can solve right now? Okay, so if it's the credit card stuff, stop spending. It's going to maybe take some time to get back that up, but even seeing that, paying back a debt is the same as investing. It's just, you know, on the downside of the cycle. It's like if there's an axis, it's like debt to wealth, you know. So it's still satisfying to see that you're coming out of debt, just like it is like when you pay off your mortgage or whatever, right? Or pay off your car loan, it should be something you're celebrating and things like that. So understanding like who you are and your relationship to money, maybe you need help because it's too stressful. Maybe your partner's good with it. Maybe you're the one who's good with it. It's really the dynamic between me and my wife is super fastidious about money, but she can't spend over $300 without like tons of stress. So it made sense in our relationship that she paid this regular bills and most of the kids' bills. And that was also because we kind of tried to plan our needs with Carrie's income and our wants with mine. My income was going to fluctuate wildly. Was going to go up, it was going to go down, it was going to be gone, it was going to be this. And also I had the the wherewithal to be able to buy, like pay for the renovations or pay for the flights or whatever it is we were doing. So personality wise, that made a lot of sense. And also, you know, I'm also not reckless with money, so I plan it and things like that. So with us, we have to sort of be careful that, you know, like every year I look at and I try to clamp, which I'll get to in a sec, but I try to clamp down our spending a little bit, sort of like tamp it down. It's a good thing. We do it in projects all the time. It's like, well, can we do, okay, we did 20 shots. Can we do 25, you know, with the same amount of people? And often you can. And it's like, there's no, weirdly, it doesn't make sense all the time, but it, you know, it's like once you're in a momentum, you can get more out of it. Like there's always shots at the end of a show that have zero budget assigned to them in the timesheets because we just got so good at them. And you can do that with your own money as well. But, you know, like I'm the type of person that I would adjust it and I would be okay. And my wife would diligently try to do it and would bang her head against the wall in stress until, so we had to realize that and have like an open communication between the two of us about what, you know, our shared kind of finish. So it's not maybe not just you that you have to think about too. It's who you're sharing your money with and who you're sharing your supports with.
I think when you have a partnership too, you want to be careful about whose habits you're spreading. Cause I think Michaela was way better with money until she met me. And then I kind of influenced her to be bad. So like, there's that aspect to keep your eyes out for too.
Yeah. Yeah. Bad. Well, good or bad. It's not.
And she always says saying things like bad is very judgy. So getting back to your judgy thing,
yeah.
Inefficient or incorrect, perhaps.
Well, like, yeah, there's like, for example, like I am careful with my money, but I'm not cheap. I would say, I hope Carrie's not listening, but she can be a little more cheap. Right. And so, but she's also like, I never have to worry about her spending. She's super diligent about it. And we've set up things over the years that work for us, which allow her to have more spending power, you know, and, but also feel good that we're collectively achieving our objectives, which I'll get into in a little, some things that we do. But so anyways, so you got to set up your, figure out what you're doing. And then this is a process that I went through, which I found really helpful. And that is, you know, people talk about financial plans and that sounds really like a bunch of spreadsheets and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, if you're not into spreadsheets, get over it and learn how to use a spreadsheet. It's not that complicated. There's a lot of artists who are like, oh my God, spreadsheets. And you don't have to be like coding, but you know, it's helpful to do math. Just open it. It's good for shot bids. You can do a lot of stuff with a spreadsheet. So maybe you can learn Maya. You can learn how to use a spreadsheet. And with the production folks, maybe take it easy. Don't go too crazy into detail. You just keep
it tables.
Just keep it like, you don't need to micro manage. At least this is my philosophy. I don't micromanage my own finances. I just create a framework where I can thrive in. So the process I went through, I got this book. I couldn't find the name of the book, unfortunately. I got out of the library and I was looking for like how to make my own financial plan. Cause at that point I had gone to a bank and they had made me no money and I was very upset with them. They were useless. And within me part-time reading stuff, I felt like I knew more about stuff than they did, which was disappointing because when you have like under $50,000, you're not getting the best and brightest financial people. Let's be honest. You're getting the entry level people at the bank who are like helping you advise you, but like, you know, look at their age and their qualifications. And you're like, you could get a really great one, but it's not a given. And then I took on a financial advisor, which my grandfather had used, and it was, and then I learned enough to realize they were not being completely honest with me. And that was annoying. And that was about how they're getting paid. And they did some things I found. So they were not very good. So I've fired them, and I was looking to go independent. So before I went, before I did that, I, you know, I like to prepare. I like to over prepare usually. So I actually looked at one point at taking the first, there's to become a financial advisor, you have to take this intro course, which is pretty extensive. And I thought, okay, well, maybe I'll do that. I was working like crazy at the time. My wife's like, do you think you have enough time for that? And I was like, I don't know, maybe. And, but anyways, then I, so I was also reading books. And I also, so instead I ended up taking a course at the Toronto Public Library with a lady named Gail Beebe, who was a financial writer. She was in a very similar position. She was like an engineer, I think, or a chemical engineer, something like that, who started to take an interest in her own money and then started to write articles and things like that from that kind of like layman's perspective. And she wrote a book called No Hype, which I'll try to link in the thing. And it was just like straight up, like, this is what this means. This is what this means. It was the most like bare bones, straight to the point, book there. And the course was great. What you find a lot of times is people will be like, well, you know, you could do this or you could do that, because no one wants to commit to your situation because they don't know your situation. They don't want to be liable. There's a lot of liabilities in that. But Gail was great, because she's like, I wouldn't do that. You'd ask her a question, she'd be like, I don't understand it. I wouldn't do it. And I was like, oh my God, this person is actually telling me what they think. So her, the main thing I took away from that is, if you don't understand it, don't invest in it. But anyways, so as part of that sort of journey, I found this book, and it was an American book. So it was a lot of 401k stuff. And, you know, that's something also we're talking about from Ontario, Canada perspective. But the best thing about it was, it was like, you should figure out why you want money. So think about like a project, like, what are we doing here? Well, we're making a movie. It has 500 shots. We're making 14 episodes. There are this many shots. There's a framework already built in there. And, you know, and like, why are we doing this? Well, we're doing it for the money, or we're doing it for art, or it's Dune, and we're going for the Oscar.
Do it for the art.
Whatever it is. Excuse me. Allergies are killing me. Whatever your overall goal is. But a lot of people don't ask themselves why they want the money. And no, there's obvious answers, like, you know, I want to retire. I want to be able to retire. But it's not the same for everybody. Like, if you have your wife is a teacher, maybe she's not worried about her retirement because that's kind of covered. So then the question is, like, why do you want your money? And they suggested it should be three things on an index card. And the index card you should put wherever you do your financial decisions. So mine's right here. And it's, yeah. Let's see if I can grab it. 1 second. Anytime I'm looking at my bank statements or whatever, I have, so I have my like mission statement, which is, let's see if you can see it. See, it's there. I wrote this like 15 years ago.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. And it stays there. I wrote V1.
V1. Is it still V1?
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
Because I haven't done it. So, because some of this stuff, you can update it, obviously. So my main mission statement, and this is, I was thinking, this would be a really good use for AI. Hmm. You know, if you say to AI, imagine you're a financial advisor, ask me 20 questions to get to my financial mission statement and my top three or four goals. And it's actually pretty good at that kind of dumb stuff, because really it's going to aggregate all the investment advice on the internet, which is kind of what you're looking at anyways. So mine is, live comfortably and do cool stuff. Well, it's not highbrow stuff here, right? Because in part of my analysis is like, I don't need to be rich. I don't need the latest car. I don't need this, whatever, but I do want to do cool stuff. And I want to, that, to me, that's important. So like, it's kind of what I was saying, I'm not being cheap. There are people, there's another site I look at a lot, Million Dollar Journey. It's a guy on a blog. His goal was to have a net worth of $1 million as soon as possible and to retire as soon as possible. And then he switched to have like passive dividend account that pays him a salary. That's his goal. But to do that, there's a group of people like that are like super savers and like they're super cheap. They don't, you know, like, whoa, we didn't go on family vacation to get this goal. And like, that's, to me, good for you. But I also want to live my life because, you know, you could die at any moment. So what's the point of, this is my own personal philosophy, but maybe that's not for you. So mine is fund a comfortable retirement, fund the kids' education, get out of debt, / more FU money, which I've talked about in the last podcast, and then see the world together. Because I realized through that process that the experience of travel was one of the most important things that I took from my parents and I wanted to share with my children. So that is my mission statement. So this has stopped me from buying stocks. Because like, does that help me do that goal? And the answer is no. You know, and then it's like, okay, well, I'm not going to do that. And so, you know, those, it's like those moments of panic where you're like, I don't know, should I buy crypto? Should I buy Disney stock? Oh my God. I was like, well, does it help me fund my comfortable retirement? Maybe. Does it help fund the kids' education? Nope. Does it help me get out of it? No. You know, so then you're like, oh, okay, it's a bit of a thing. Plus, you're looking at that all the time. This is like real world use for money. So we spend money on trips. It's one of my biggest expenditures outside of paying off mortgages and all that kind of stuff. And I don't mind that because it's one of my goals. If it was like,
I value.
Yeah. If you love cars and you wanted to buy cars, put it on the list, but not number one, you know? So this is a really good exercise to go through. Even if you don't come up with the perfect, it doesn't have to be perfect, but like if it gets you somewhere and it makes you think about, okay, why? So like, why am I killing? And then it leads to these, why am I killing myself on this project or show in this business or whatever? Why am I doing this? Well, it's because I want to do this. And so I find it helpful in stressful moments of work to sort of refocus, like, why am I doing this? And I've taken that kind of game on in different and made it into smaller things, like particularly in the last little while where, you know, it's going to be volatile. When I took the job at Squeeze, I'm like, I know it was only for a year at the time. It was only for a year. And I'm like, I'm going to, in that goal, obviously it's paying the bills and stuff, but I'm going to try to get out of debt. And I know I have a year contract. I'm going to get out of debt. And then when I re-upped, I'm like, okay, I'm going to put more money in the kids' education. And then when I got laid off and brought back, then I was like, I'm going to pay 1 year of tuition with that job. You know what I mean? Like, so you can, once you get in the habit of creating these kind of like games for yourself, you just get better at playing them in different contexts. And that's super important. And that's without getting into like, oh, the dividend yield is blah, 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 blah. You don't have to, it's just more like, when you have a purpose for money, it's the same thing you would teach your children. You know, if you look at like, what should you teach your children? Well, make money, take it, put it aside, and set a goal for it. We do the same thing in production. Okay, we have this many people. What's our goal for the week? We want to hit 20. Let's set it at 25. Okay, we didn't make it. Okay, we'll adjust. We got 22 instead. But, you know, it's the same logic that you're applying to your own goals in finance. And if you, you know, it's really easy when you work as hard as we do to sort of like put aside your own health or your own financial stuff. And I am definitely guilty of it, but you shouldn't, you know? So anyways, so that's kind of, you know, when you, that's kind of the initial kind of assessment, I think. It's like, okay, what are we going to do? And I'll try to go through the other stuff a little bit quicker. So then you got to start peeling back the layers. So in a show, it would be like, okay, now you're getting into specifics. And you want to, ideally, you want to build something that you can see up against. Like, okay, I expect that I should have, so I looked at my finances, I cut this fee. I should have $100 on this paycheck available. Okay, so what you can start to do is look for like easy wins. Like, are you paying bank fees? Because to me, that's insane. I can't stand paying bank fees. Maybe you should switch banks to one that doesn't charge you fees. If you're paying $20 for a bank to use your money to make interest off you, it seems like a bad deal. So like, are there things, cutting spending is one thing, but cutting like useless fees or things you're not using, those are obvious wins, right? And then the trick is to take that win and do something positive with it right away. Because then you feel the results. So if I take $20, say I'm paying $20 in bank fees and I switch banks, now I'm going to take that $20 and I'm going to put it in a savings account. Oh, excuse me. So you don't get to investing until you have money to invest. So, you know, first thing you need to do is build a habit of saving so that you have, you know, again, you're taking in more money than you're spending. Then the question is, what are you doing with that money? So the first thing you do is you start to save it. So you can do things that are targeted. I like to ratchet it up. So it's like, okay, I'm going to try $50 a pay. And I put it in a joint savings. We did this when we were thinking about a mortgage. To me, the mortgage still was insane. Like, okay, we're going to spend $1 bajillion. And once you're locked in, you're in it for 20 to 30 years or whatever it is. So we started to go, okay, well, how much would that be? So it would be an extra this X amount of dollars, let's say $500 for the sake of argument. While we're looking for a house, I'm going to take $500 out of my pay and I'm going to put it in a savings account. And I'm going to make the feeling of paying that mortgage. And then after a few months, you're like, do we notice? No, it's pretty good. And a lot of people, this happens in projects as well. A lot of people will be like, well, we can't possibly do this. We can't, it's impossible, impossible, impossible bullshit. I can't tell you how many times someone's told me it's impossible. And then we've done it the very next day. And then it's like within two or three weeks they go, oh yeah, I guess it was possible. Yes, I'm sorry, but it's true. So it doesn't matter how much, if it's $5, if it's $200, if it's $10,000. If you've got it, put it away. Because if you're the type of person that you're like worried about not having the money, then you need to maybe go slower. So $5, then try $10, then try 15, then try 20, then try whatever. If you're in a position where you think your job is unstable, you should save way more. You should be super aggressive and put pressure on yourself to get your spending down, to put that money aside because you're going to need it. And if you don't need it, then you're laughing. So for the last 4 years since like the writer's strike, I've cranked up my emergency fund, you know, things. And as a result, I'm not worried about being, well, I'm worried about it. I'm much less worried about not having a job right now. I'm maybe save too much, to be honest. And now it's like a, you know, if an investment person is like, you maybe you should do something with that money. But this is the problem you want to have. So we started with like $25. And then, you know, then you come up with new goals. Well, I want to say like my kid's soccer is very expensive now because he's in playing rep soccer. So Carrie started to have problems, like she had to put out these big outlays of cash, which generally I would do. So she started a savings account, like a buffer, where she put in like a small amount. And then it's the opposite of a credit card. She saved ahead. And when that big expense came out, it went down. So she had like an account, savings account, just for those big twice a year, three times a year expenses. And that didn't, that took like a couple of years to get up off the ground. And it started with very small increments. So first thing you want to do is make sure that you're building a savings habit. Whatever that habit is, start with whatever you think you can, and then push yourself until the point where you're like unhappy there was a point where I looked at our expenses and I thought, man, I'm spending a lot on Starbucks, and I'm working remote, and I do like the lap at lunch. This Starbucks has since left, but it was exactly 15 minutes there and 15 minutes back. And I was like, oh, and I stopped doing it. And I thought, and I was miserable because my walk was pointless.
What was your joy for the day?
Well, it was like when we were in COVID, we would go for a walk. I would go for walks with the kids, and we used to jokingly call them the prison walks, because you couldn't go anywhere or do anything or whatever. And it just got to a point where you're just like, there's no purpose to go here. Now that's my own weird psychology, but having somewhere to go and get something and come back was worth the $2 billion in Starbucks that I was spending. But then, you know, when the job started getting a little more unstable, I cut it back by half, you know? So, and honestly, didn't notice a difference. And I think that's the big thing. You'd be surprised how much you can put, you know how much you can push yourself because other people are doing it to you all the time. You just have to do it to yourself as well. You know what I mean? If I was on a project, people would be like, oh, we need this. And I'd just be like, no, you can't have it. And they'd be like, bah! And then within a week, it's like, maybe I'm wrong and that's a disaster. But eight out of 10 times, I'm like, it's fine. It's totally fine. In some cases, it's not even like it's annoying. Sometimes it's annoying and you had to maybe mitigate that. But often it's just like so not noticed ever again. It's shocking. So if you can kind of take on that ruthless producer with yourself, then I think you'll get some good results. So, you know, as you peel back your layers, like you almost want to gamify it. I think that's like a useful way to do it. If you're into video game, most of people we work with have some affinity with
familiarity
video games. And the thing is, VFX people and animation people are trained to like hit go for goals. But we don't often do it in our own life, which is maybe because that's a lot, but in this case, it could benefit you quite a bit. So I think taking that on is kind of useful, I think. And then, you know, then you have to kind of start to get into like the weeds. I mean, and this is more the traditional stuff. It's like, okay, well, you know, the traditional thing is get out of debt, build up a bit of a savings. And I'm saying, let's from scratch or young, hopefully young. But then people tell you should build up an emergency fund, okay? And that's the traditional advice. For me, I always struggled with that a little bit because I did have a bit of an emergency fund, and especially if you're with a partner, sometimes you have a joint account just to keep things fluid. But I always felt like it was kind of a waste to have too much cash sitting there. It's not till very recently that I've had a real emergency fund. I had some version of it, but it was not great. I had line of credits as like a backup, which is not great considering what I just said earlier. But employment prospects were good. Our expenses weren't crazy. And there's two of us. So, you know, if you both worked in visual effects and animation, you should have a bigger emergency fund for sure. So the question is, how big should that be? You need to be able to decide that. You need to know what you're spending and what you need to spend. And so like having a kind of like a parachute of like, so when I talked about, I should plug in my phone. I'm going to run out of juice here. But if you know, like, okay, I'm spending $2 billion on on stuff I want, and you want to be able to boil it down quickly to what you need. So, you know, like, so when I lost my job recently, I'm like, I know I need to cancel my news subscription, cancel this, you know, and I had a list already drawn up because I'd already done it like 2 years ago. If you have a mortgage, maybe you can renegotiate your mortgage. That's what I did. Often they want you to keep paying. The trade-off there is they will extend the period of time, which they will make more money off you again.
Yeah, your interest payments go up.
Again, remember the money. But if you have a mortgage where you can like double payments or add every year, you can extend the thing. And then when you get a job again, you just double your payments, and then you've got a lower baseline. So there's things like that that you can do to make it a little easier on yourself as well, which I think you should do. So the emergency fund, then you're talking about usually retirement, education we've talked about is a big one. So retirement's either a TFSA or RSP. I'm not going to get into which one you should do. If you make, generally speaking, if you want to reduce taxes, which I would think you would, an RSP is a good thing, but it's locked in. A TFSA is better if you don't have a lot of money, if you're starting out now. But at some point you may want to like reduce your taxes. It depends how much money you're making and all that kind of stuff. This is where you should see someone professionally. Education, that's a big one. There's different ways to do that. You can try to fund the whole education. You can try to maximize the grants. That's what I did. I didn't fund the whole education. We put it in a family one so that either I have two kids, either kid could use it. And I just set up a like a thing for my wife where she had to put in a certain amount per year to maximize the amount of money we'd get from the government and no more. And the idea was that we would take the other money and we would save it in somewhere else so that if my kids made enough money to do something, God forbid, then we would have that money somewhere else. It wouldn't be tied into the RSP, but if they needed help, we could give it to them, that kind of thing. So in that case, once you start to get into like into the groove, you can start to look ahead and go, okay, well, when's my mortgage going to be paid off? And if I accelerated that by 3 years, what would that get me? And you, again, it starts to turn into this game of like, well, if I can get the boss early, then I can do this. And, you know, and that's where money starts to become a little fun.
Nerd.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, oh, look at me. I'm going to be
retired on a mountain of money,
a millionaire by this date. And you know, with that in mind, like, so it's funny because when you start, you're like, oh my God, I have zero cash. And I started late. So it looks like nothing, but I can tell you 15 years later, it's like, it's not nothing. It's kind of like, holy shit. And it's the same if you, like, if you look at your wife's pension over the years, it's like, oh my God, there's a lot of money in here. You know what I mean? And the fact is you need a shit ton of money to retire. And, you know, there's, you know, my dad had a pension, my mom didn't. So, my dad's got a really good pension, but those really good pensions are almost non-existent. My wife's pension's okay. You know, the teacher's pensions are great, but those are
every generation's getting more and more screwed on the benefits front at work for sure.
So apparently you need like $1.7 million to retire comfortably. I don't know who made that number up, and some people say it's too high, and some people, but anyways, you need like a couple, and like being a millionaire is not as cool as it used to be.
Yeah,
you know, if you own a house in Toronto, you're a millionaire technically. You may not have any money, but you're a millionaire as far as net worth. So, you know, don't get discouraged at the beginning, because there'll be a point where you're like, oh my God, I actually have to think of now I have enough money that it's like serious. Like I could, people could be, you know, you could hire hitmen for this kind of money. You know what I mean? And you know, it doesn't, if you're, the more diligent you are, the faster you're going to see that. And then that's when it kind of gets exciting and also scary in a different way, because then there's like more at stake. So So the other one is, another common one is mortgage. And again, you have to look at, I think you have to look at investments and things like that the same way as debt. So if you're paying 8% on your mortgage and you're making 4% in your investments, you're losing money. If I put $100 in a mortgage and $100 in, I'm getting more from mortgage. Now, the thing is, I'm not getting money from that. I'm saving myself money over time. Whereas maybe you need to make money to have that money. So it gets a little bit tricky there, but it's something to keep in mind. If we have lived in the last little while in very low interest rates for a long time. When I got my first mortgage, it was a 4.94, and that was like crazy low. And everyone assumed it was going to go closer to 6 to 8%. So I was like planning and, you know, putting more money aside in case that was the case. Or I was upping my mortgage payments so that the interest rates go up, I could drop them down, it would be about the same. And then the interest rates went lower. So I was like, okay, well, I'm just going to keep that same amount there. And now I'm putting more to my principal. So but you don't know that. Like, you can't sort of predict that. So you have to be kind of careful about that kind of stuff. But you still have to keep looking at it. Okay, what, you know, there's no point making 6% in your RSP if you're, you know, paying 18% on your credit cards. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. So, yeah. And then once you get into that kind of situation, once you start saving, once you start building that kind of thing, you get some momentum. And then with the momentum, you know, like when a project starts working, everyone feels relieved in a way. And they're like, oh, and then you start to, like, instead of focusing on the anxiety of money, you're focusing on, like, again, with these goals.
On the solution.
With these goals in mind, you're like, well, now you're like, well, how are we doing? Like, are we almost done this project? Are we almost done this goal? Like, okay, well, we've done it. And, like, you know, recently, some of these things are like happened. Like, oh, the kids are going to school. Shit. You know, or like, we're out of debt. You know, like, it sort of like takes you by surprise when it happens, but then you're like, okay, cool. It's like when a project finishes and everyone's like, oh, well, that wasn't so bad. Like, there wasn't some crazy panic or whatever. Well, you know, great. Next. What's the next project? And then you can start to think about what you want to do rather than what you need to do. And that's, in the end, that's kind of the goal, is to be in that position where you can do things you want to do. So there's a couple of things that someone like told me, which I think are useful. So here's some, just like some tips now that I would say that are kind of maybe weirdly specific. So if you have under $10,000, you shouldn't be thinking about investing in stocks and all that kind of stuff. It's not enough. If you buy stocks, you pay a commission. There are now brokerages where commissions on stocks or ETFs, exchange traded funds, which are essentially groups of stocks, and you maybe pay them on the back end. So you can still do it, but you don't have enough money to diversify. And again, that's something you want to think about in all your things, diversification. Like, I have money in real estate, I have money in this. And you can think about it from a career perspective too. Like, I have skills in VFX, I have skills in animation, I have skills in business. Like diversifying in general is not a bad idea. You know, like, I can do lighting, I can do modeling, all the same logic. So if you have under $10,000, you should probably just park it in a all-in-one fund. That would be my advice. You can take it or leave it. But there's so many good things, so many good all-in-one funds now. It's so much easier than when I started to do that. There was a couple mutual funds. And, you know, really, at that point, you're just trying to build that up. Again, maybe you don't want to buy stocks. I don't buy stocks. I do what's called index investing. And the Canadian couch potato is the one I decided that fits my vibe. So it essentially decides how risk tolerant are you? And mine is, it goes from like not risk tolerant to aggressive. Mine's assertive. And again, your time frame matters here. So assertive means you do 25% in Canadian index funds. And an index fund basically means it takes the mutual fund or the ETF, looks at the whole stock market and takes the same representative amount of stocks in their fund. So when stocks go up, your stocks go up. When stocks go down, they go down. It's not, and whatever the strongest companies in that stock market are what you're buying all the time. So the S&P 500, for example, which is another one, is like the top 500 companies in the US. If one falls out, another one comes in, you own that. And you don't have to think or do anything about it. You just buy the index fund, done. Generally, they have low fees because, you know, if you're paying 2% fees on a mutual fund, that's 2% you're not getting, right? So they have low fees. There's the TD Index e-funds, they're called, which are low fund mutual funds. So the reason I use those is because you can put money into them regularly without any commission fees. But you could now probably do the same thing with ETFs if you went to the right brokerage. But that's like you investing and opening a brokerage account, which may be too much for you. If not, there's things like there's lots of robo-advisors, there's like all-in-one funds that you can do. Maybe your work has something equivalent, like DNEG had something like that. So whatever it is, you should do more research on that. But that's what I do. I use the Canadian couch potato idea. And I learned how to use the TD Waterhouse site and learned how to buy stocks and stuff like that. I'm still a touch nervous about it when I do it, but I'm not. It's pretty easy, actually. I can do it from my phone, which is kind of crazy. The only thing you can't buy is like GICs. You have to phone somebody. GICs are like guaranteed investment certificates, which is like you're going to put your money in for a year and you're going to definitely get this. And there's no volatility to it. It's like someone making you a promise. So sometimes I'll buy those. And I'm very bad. One thing I'm very bad at is I've had buy GICs on my list for like probably like a year now. I still haven't done it. I still haven't called them. So then when you get about $50,000, maybe this is where you start to look at how should I be investing this? And you could do this through a financial advisor as well. It's the same logic. It's just, you have to think about how they're getting paid and they may start to suggest you go into this fund or that fund. And maybe that's fine, but, that's where I think you should do some homework, but maybe at that point you're past the sort of anxiety point and you now have the wherewithal to do that. Yeah. So like, are you going to go with a bank? I'm not sure I would go with a bank, but DIY, that's not for everybody. I decided DIY with a simple approach because I don't have to figure out a lot of stuff. I just have to figure out a few things and it's pretty simple. And the interfaces and stuff like that are getting really quite good. So, and there's more competition in the market to the point where like even TD started to give things for commission free, which is cool. So here's my like number one hot tip. This is the second thing my financial advisor gave me, which was of any use. Okay. So this is like how to make. So Graham, do you put money into RSPs at all?
Yep.
Okay. Do you, then at the end of the year, you take all that money that you, so you put in like, you know, X amount of dollars and you take that money. And what do you do with that money when you got it?
With the
tax money.
Leave it there. I'm leaving it till I retire.
Well, you get tax money at the end of the year though.
Oh yeah. That goes back to the RSP.
Okay. That's good. But did you know that there is a form that you can fill out called a T1203. With the government. So if you're putting in, say you're putting in $100 a paycheck into your RSP. So if you're doing it through work and they're matching it or something like that, they will calculate that. And if you have a pension, they calculate this. But if you're on your own, you're taking 100 after tax dollars and you're putting in an RSP. And then you wait a year-ish to get that money back. Maybe you're getting, for the sake of argument, let's say $40 in tax. You're getting, so you put in $100 a week and you're going to get the aggregate of $40 of that $100 back in April or whatever. You can fill out this form, and all you have to do is you usually fill it out in October, November, and you prove that you're putting in $100 a week. So you have to send a picture of I use Tangerine, a picture of my Tangerine withdrawal that says it's going to my TD account, which is the thing. This also works for daycare. What they'll do is they'll take that assessment. You have to figure out, okay, well, I'm going to, so $100 a year, $100 a pay. So that's going to be $2,600 a year. That's going to go into my RSPs. Then they'll look at that. They'll process it and they'll give you a letter to give to your employer, which says, don't pay the tax. Like, it's called reduction of tax at the source. This person doesn't have to pay the tax on that $100.
Wow.
So you get the $40 right away in your next paycheck. So let's say you are single or, you don't have kids. You take that $100 and you know you're getting $40 extra on your pay. You take that $100 goes into RSP, then you invest it. How are you going to invest it? Then you take the $40 and put it into your tax-free savings account. So all of a sudden, the $100 you're putting in your RSP is now $140. Now, the coolest thing is, instead of the government holding your $100 every week and making money on it from you, you get to do that. So every month now, you're compounding interest. So if you started in January, you're compounding, or let's say, January. You're compounding interest, whatever that interest is, whether you're stocks or whatever, high interest savings account, even 2%. 2% every month is going to you so that by the time April tax return comes around, you've made more money on that money that you put than you would have gotten your tax return.
Wow, that's crazy.
And let me do one better. Okay, so if you have children and you're putting money in RSPs, RESPs, Registered Education Savings Accounts, you can take the $100, you get the $40 back, you put that into the RESP, and then the government gives you $8 right away in a grant. So now you've turned $100 into $148. That's easy math.
It's crazy.
And it's one form. And no one I know no one knows about this form. So I'll give you another practical thing. Say you are, new parents and you're paying a freaking fortune in daycare, unless you live in Quebec. That form is a federal form, by the way. So it's not an Ontario thing. So this works across Canada. Carrie was paying like $1 jillion, and like most of her salary, I had to take extra bills and all this kind of stuff, because most of her salary is going into paying daycare. It was crazy. Like, I don't even remember how much it was, but I just remember it was earth shattering. If you can use the tax at the source form, because you're gonna get a tax credit on the daycare you pay. But one of the items that you can claim on that T1-203 is daycare. So say you're paying $500, let's say you're paying $1,000 a month in daycare, and you're paying 40% tax. They're going to give you $400 back into your pay. So I can get it all. I can get this giant check at the end, but my cash flow day to day will be like $400 or whatever your tax is better every paycheck. And it went from making daycare like an insane stress to way more manageable. Mm-hmm. Now, you didn't get a big check at the end of the year, but you could live throughout the year. And it slowly goes down as your daycare costs go down, but then your daycare costs are going down. So it's that was a massive, massive thing for if you're paying daycare. So this is something I like to tell everyone I know about this thing because it's made such a huge difference in accumulating the money, right? So you could do $100, take the $40, put the $40 in, and then cash that back at the end of the year, or you could put it in your TFSA, or you could put it in your trip fund, or whatever. Or maybe it makes it so that maybe you can barely afford $100 to put in your RSP. So maybe it makes it so that really you're only putting in, you're taking $100 into your RSP, but it only feels like 60. Like whatever flavor of that is, it's like a massive thing. And it's pretty easy to do, like once a year. The main problem I had is I would forget and then be like in December, go, oh, damn, I got it. Cause it sometimes takes a month or two to process. So then when you're used to it, that first couple of paychecks in January, which are already a little lower because of whatever, would be like really low because you didn't have your tax at the source. So it's like, oh. So anyway, so that's a really good one that I would highly recommend anybody looks into. If you're putting money aside on your own and you're putting it in a registered fund, then you should definitely be taking advantage of that. And then, you know, there's things like, you know, like if a company is matching your RSPs and you're not taking advantage of it, what are you thinking? Like, do it. It's free money. Like, would you turn down a raise? No. So try to figure out how to do that. And then, you know, that's kind of like the main tips that I would put in place. Like, I didn't want to get too far into investing and stuff because that's a little bit different for everybody, but you'll hear about passive income. This idea of passive income is quite trendy right now. Really all that is you invest and you get some kind of dividend, whether it's a dividend through your mutual funds or a dividend through a stock dividend. And a dividend is essentially just like, thanks for being a shareholder, here's a payment. And there's a whole investment strategy built on dividends, which is quite useful. And if you had like, if you have enough money in your investments and you're getting like a 4 or 5% dividend, then you can live off the dividends, but you have to have quite a lot of money in that investment to do that. But that's something to aspire to for sure. And a lot of people do that. And there's lots of information about dividend investing and, or they call it drip, like you get a dividend and then you reinvest it in your RSP. But that's all passive income really means, is basically like, because you could have a stock that fluctuates, but if the dividend doesn't fluctuate, you'll still get the dividend payout, right? So it's worth $100 today, it's worth $80 tomorrow, but they're still paying a 4% dividend regardless. So you'll get a cash payment. So passive income sounds really like sexy, and it is, but it's really quite boring. And that's my main kind of advice, is like, if it's really hot and sexy, then it's probably very volatile and highly risky. Like, I don't do crypto. And like, I've talked to people and they're like, yeah, I'm learning how to do crypto and all stuff. I'm like, do you understand it? They're like, well, I'm learning about it. I'm like, okay, well, there's people I know who do understand it. I'm like, then go crazy. But I don't understand it. I'm not buying. So I did actually, to be fair, I did buy some crypto, but I did it in the most boring way possible. And I bought an exchange traded fund of people who are good at crypto, and I bought some crypto, and that has lost me money. I bought it because Donald Trump was in and he was all about the crypto.
Oh yeah.
And I'm like, it's going to go up. Wrong. Like most things.
Everything with Trump's name on it goes down.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyways, so yeah. So in the end, it's like be boring, but be sort of like relentless.
Relentlessly boring.
Relentlessly boring, like small incremental stuff. And, you know, it's like, it's so cliche. Like, you know, you can do all these harebrained schemes to try to like make money, but in the end, the most boring ways, like really rich people are usually in boring businesses doing boring, predictable things. Like, you know,
they're not making movies.
Yeah, like I honestly, making movies is probably one of the worst investments you could make. That's what you do when you have lots of money, because it's like, I don't know, I'm going to buy a sports car or make a movie, you know?
Make your movie with other people's money.
Exactly. So, I don't know, hopefully that was useful. I don't know if you had anything to
add. No, that's great. I actually learned a lot. I like your little tricks.
The T1203 is the one I always like when people...
I'm gonna send my kids back to school just so I can capitalize.
Well, you can do it with your RSPs right away, right? So, so that's kind of cool. I mean, although, like, I'm not contributing to my RSP at the moment because I'm not working. So, but as soon as I do, I will. But yeah, like, it'll take time. That's the thing you have to learn, is like, it's not going to come overnight. And when I took that class, I had not very much money, and I was like, okay. And then, you know, grows. You don't be conservative, like, you know, like I chart every year how much I did that year, and I'm shooting for 6% as an aggressive target. Like, it used to be a standard, like, oh, you expect 8%, and I was like, and then you look at the trends, like, it's not actually 8%. So that's them selling you this. If you want to be conservative, you pick 4. It depends on your asset allocation, things like that. But, you know, there's been times where it's been way up, and there's been times where I lost money. Like, there's years where I lose money. And if you have trouble with that, then maybe that's, you have to look at your risk tolerance and things like that. Like, and the more money you have, the more money you build, the more those fluctuations will be like, you know, lots of money, like scary amounts of money. And if you can handle that, great. Maybe if not, then you have to think about other things. Maybe real estate or something like that, because your house is not an investment. That's another classic. Like, you can't eat your house. And so I think the big thing in VFX right now is like the emergency fund. If you're working, and I would be putting money, this is something people are like, well, should I be saving money? Yes. Like, if you're lucky enough to keep working, or that next job happens, or you get that next year contract, then maybe you can start to take that money you've saved and invest it, but maybe keep the same level of paranoia.
Like, I know exactly people who have been doing a really good job working on a project, and the studio goes out of business.
Yeah.
It's like, you have no contribution to that at all. You could be doing everything perfectly, but the parent company disappears, and
Well, Pixamundo was a good example. No warning. Pixamundo doing great work, lots of people making big deals, and then boom, gone. And that's just like a corporate. So that's something else you should be thinking of too, is like, if you're working for a company, it gets bought. If there's not volatility right away, there's probably some coming. Not always, but these are things that I think it's a healthy suspicion is good for your money. And when you're planning projects and stuff like that too, it's the same logic. It's like, okay, I can pay for what I need. Great. I can pay for what I want. Maybe I'll hold back a little bit in case that want or need changes. And, or you can set up triggers like, well, if this happens, if we're successful here and it's going well, then I'll spend this money. So often I'll try to like get another compositor in the resource schedule. The recruiters are looking, instead of looking for 3, look for 4. I don't know if I'll be able to hire the 4th, but if we do well on these other things and we don't do overtime or we get extra shots, then I can pay for these people. So if you're thinking kind of like those, like, if things go wrong, I'm okay. If things go well, I can implement this idea. If you pre-think those things out a little bit and pre-plan them out, then you're kind of ready to go, and there's less stress when it happens. And if it's definitely, if something bad happens and you're more prepared, like we talked about last week, then you can kind of be in a better rational state and deal with the things you need to deal with instead of having an extra layer of stress. The main thing and I've said this before, it's like project planning is, well, working in visual effects animation is a giant exercise in managing anxieties, client anxieties, team anxieties, business anxieties. It's like more and more psychology is my focus in these things. And money is exactly the same. Like, people get divorced over money. You know, it's like, it's a massive stress. And so if you can remove the stress and anxiety out of your project will go better. You can remove stress and anxiety, maybe not all of it, but as much as you can from your finances, your life will be better for sure. So I'm sure other people have ideas and comments. Hopefully, maybe they have earth-shattering tips for us all to get rich.
And the comments, by the way, are good. They encourage us to keep going. So please,
yeah, we like those. I think the algorithm likes those too, but I don't know if we're in that zone yet. But anyways.
Tens of viewers. Yes.
In the end, remember what Wu-Tang would do, and that is focus on the cash, you know? So hopefully, I wish everybody riches and fame. Maybe not fame, but riches. But you have to remember, it starts slowly and it is kind of boring. But if you're looking for something to do when you're underemployed or whatever, learning about your own money is a good thing. You never lose on getting better at money. And even if you're gonna hire someone else to do it, then that's all good too. So there you go. That's like, subscribe. Hopefully you like that one. It's a bit of a weird departure, but it's a lot of people asking me. Yeah, and hopefully it's useful. And yeah, until the next time, we'll see you then.
Ciao for now.
Au revoir.